You know, the Terracotta Army, there are over 7,000 Terracotta warriors. And with those warriors, there were all kinds of things buried. But the interesting thing, now this was 2,000 years ago, those swords that they found were still sharp. And that's because they had chromium in them. Well, we didn't figure out how to manufacture with chromium until the 1800s. And I was astounded, you know, how did these people figure this out, you know, so long ago?
Our Bay Area innovator today is Jack Bialik, author of Lost in Time, a book that uncovers a striking pattern in human history again and again. Civilizations discover extraordinary knowledge, only to lose it, forget it, or see it deliberately destroyed. With a career in technology and decades of curiosity behind them, Jack spent 10 years tracking these mysteries, from ancient surgeries and vanished libraries to Roman inventions we still can't explain. In this conversation, we explore how knowledge is lost, how it can be preserved, and why wisdom and good morals, not information or technology, is the key to moving forward. This is Bay Area Innovators, and I'm your host, Steve Espas. Jack, welcome to Bay Area Innovators.
Thank you, Steve. Glad to be here. Yeah.
Fantastic to have you here from Phoenix, Arizona, online. So you wrote a book that's called Lost in Time. And, you know, there's just so many elements about the book that if you take this individually, they may not be a big deal. But you kind of combined all of this ancient, amazing facts and amazing knowledge that was kind of built up in ancient times and you kind of bring it together in this book. Please give us a bit of background, you know, why you wrote the book, what was your thinking and what you were hoping to accomplish with it?
Yeah, sure. Well, thank you. Yeah, the byline to the book is our forgotten and vanishing knowledge, which is interesting. How can you write about forgotten and vanishing knowledge? You know, this all came to me, you know, it took 10 years of work to put this book together. And the biggest point about it is I found like secrets hidden in plain sight, like certain pieces of information where we have found knowledge and then lost it or forgotten or it was destroyed. And then found it again, and then lost it again, and then found it again. I mean, multiple times. And this seems to happen over history, that that we make this cyclical kind of loss and found with knowledge.
And just to put it in context, you talk about things like cataract surgery thousands of years ago, or plumbing, or a computer, or, you know, all these things that really seem amazing, and again, you kind of combine them all together. How did you get around doing this research? What was your state of mind as you were going through it?
Yeah, well, you know, it just started with one thing. I saw a show, and they were talking about Roman vending machines in ancient Rome. You know, in 200 BC. I thought, wow, that's amazing. A vending machine where you would take a Roman coin, put it in the vending machine, and it would dispense holy water at temples. Wow. And actually, it would dispense steam and be on the face of an idol where it would make the idol look like they were crying. And the temples would do this to try to make money, get people to put more coins in for this amazing feat, you know. I thought, wow, I always thought that vending machines were a relatively new thing, you know. And if you do some research, you can see they started making vending machines in the 1500s. And they were a simple box where you would just put a coin in the box and you'd open the top of the box and you could take out snuff or tobacco and use that, you know. It was on the honor system. It didn't dispense it. But, you know, here was one example of something. So I started looking at other examples, and you touched on one of them there where they did cataract surgery in 800 BC.
Wow, 3,000 years ago.
Yeah, Shushruta did cataract surgery. He did other medical things, too. He did nose surgery and treated diabetes and many things. But we go way back and they have the Ebers papyrus that shows us where they were doing cataract surgery in 2400 BC in ancient Egypt. This again is something where, you know, we think it's a modern achievement, and yet the ancients were doing the same thing.
Let's talk about some of your favorite ancient, you know, mysteries or knowledge that's been lost. And I know you have in your book something about the Babylonians, that they would multiply and the numbers. Please tell us about that.
Yeah. Well, the Babylonians had an interesting method for addition and subtraction by using their fingers. And it's an interesting technique. And I have that detailed in my book on how to do it. And by moving your fingers, you could do multiplication very simply.
Give us an example.
I was gonna move to the number zero, actually. Yes, yes. And talk a little bit about zero, because the number zero is interesting. You know, we'd think that the number zero has been around for a long, long time, but the number zero really came to us relatively recently in the 1100s. The number zero was used by people that were traders on boats, and they had to have a way to show that they had zero of something. So they started using the number zero. But if we go back a little bit further to the Romans, they didn't have the number zero at all. They, in Roman numerals, you can't draw a number zero. There's no way to do it. They don't have an image for that. But you can go back even further back. The Babylonians had the number zero in their lettering system. The number zero follows the same track of information that we've had, and we've lost, and we find it again because we need it.
Let's talk about the Babylonians. They had this system where they would actually have use their hands as a calculator. Can you give us an example of how that actually worked?
So they would use their hands. They put their hands up like this. And let's use the example of 9 times 3. So what they would do is count 3 fingers over and hold that
from left to right, right?
They use from left to right, correct, yeah. From left to right. So 9 times 3, that's 27. Another example.
So let's get that right. So basically, yeah, you count 9 times 3, you count the 3, and then it's the answer is like 2 here and 7 on the other side, basically.
Right.
Yeah, that's pretty
right.
Amazing. Yeah. Let's do nine times eight.
9 times 8. So if we count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, hold that figure down. So we got 72.
Yeah, you got 7 and 2. Yeah, that's a calculator right there from, 2,000, 3,000, 5,000 years ago. Another ancient mystery, and in so many ways, it's the last remaining wonder of the world, the pyramids in Egypt, Giza. I did a lot of research myself on this, and there's just so many unanswered questions, so many amazing coincidences. What did you find out? You know, people always look at how they were built, but the age of the pyramids itself, it's always been a question, like how old are they?
Yeah, so this has been a long standing question, and my take on it is they use technology that we don't have. I mean, they didn't have wheels and they didn't have pulleys. So obviously they didn't need wheels and pulleys. I did the calculations, 2.3 million stones, and they did it in 20 years. So they'd have to lay one stone every 2 minutes, 12 hours a day, 365 days a year for 20 years. And perfectly flat, perfectly level, without pulleys or wheels. So, you know, somehow they did that with some kind of technology that we don't have today, because it's been lost. It's been lost in time. There are some people who have done some research and have looked at some of the weather patterns on the Sphinx, And they believe that those pyramids could be much older than what we think they are. We think they were built in, I think, the 2500 BC time frame. And what they're seeing could make them as old as 10,000 years old. You know, information gets lost, knowledge gets lost. Apparently, however they built those, that got lost as well.
That's right. And from what I understand, carbon dating can only be done, it cannot be done when the stone was cut. So The stone itself, you cannot carbon date. You can, but it's millions of years old. That's when the stone was formed. The only thing you can calculate is the mortar that's in between the stones, but that mortar could have been added much, much later, or it can be replaced much, much later. Or in many cases, there is no mortar because the stones are so tied together that there's no space between them. They're like perfectly aligned. So that's another pretty amazing old ancient knowledge right there.
Yeah, it's a mystery, yeah.
What would you say are some of your most amazing facts or some of your favorite discoveries that you made from ancient times, ancient knowledge?
Yeah, there's a lot of really interesting things. Well, the one that really fascinated me was from the Terracotta Army. You know, the Terracotta Army is in China. There are over 7,000 terracotta warriors in over 300 acres of land there. And with those warriors, there were all kinds of things buried. There was swords, there was knives, bows and arrows, there was musical equipment and that sort of thing. But the interesting thing, now this was 2,000 years ago, those swords that they found were still sharp. And, you know, if you find a sword that was buried like in the Middle Ages that they used in the 1300s, those swords are pitted and rusted. You know, I mean, you can barely even tell they're a sword anymore. But these swords from the ancient China, from Qin Shi was the name of the emperor at that time, those swords are still sharp. And that's because they had chromium in them. They were manufactured with chromium. Well, we didn't figure out how to manufacture with chromium until the 1800s. And I was astounded, you know, how did these people figure this out, you know, so long ago? Really amazing.
So again, I think that what's really interesting about your book is how you put all of these together. Because if you find an individual fact like that, you may think, okay, it's just one-off, it's a coincidence, it's something that, you know, doesn't mean anything, but when you put them together, it's a different story. Now, I think you have with you a dodecahedron, something from the Roman Empire. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, so the ancient Roman dodecahedron. Now, this is an interesting artifact. They found about 100 of these, maybe a little over 100 of these. They're made out of bronze. This one here is just a replica. It's probably laser printed or something, but at any rate, it looks like how they look. You can look them up. They have these little balls on the end. So this is a dodecahedron, which means it has 12 sides. If you cut this in half, you can see there's six sides on top. There's one in the middle and four around here, and then there's six more on the bottom. So it's a six-sided object. And each of the sides has a hole of a different size. I don't know if you can see that, but there's some small holes and some larger ones. And the interesting thing about this artifact is that we don't know what it was used for. I mean, we have no idea what these were used for. Now, there's some people that say they were used for sewing or for measuring distance, for maybe fighting. Somehow they were like some kind of a Molotov cocktail. You put something inside of it. But the problem with this is we don't know what it's for. There's nothing written. There's no pictures of it in any books. Nobody drew pictures of it. We don't know who manufactured them other than that it was Romans. This is an example of lost knowledge where it's lost.
Yes.
And we have many examples of that as well. There's other examples. There's a document in the Yale University Library called the Voynich Document Manuscript. It's written in a language, and there's drawings on it, very odd drawings of ladies dancing and different plants and that sort of thing. And scholars and linguists have done a lot of analysis on this document, and they know that it's written in a real language. They could do mathematical tests on the language and determine that it follows a natural pattern for a real language. And the interesting thing is we don't know what it says. We can't decode it.
Wow.
And they've had cryptologists, linguists. There's been several people that say they know what it says, but that there's no agreement in with scholars on the decoding of that particular document.
Let's move on to libraries. I think in your second chapter of the book, you talk about the lost libraries. Of course, the most famous one that comes to mind is the Library of Alexandria that burned down. So the Library of Alexandria, there were tens of thousands of scrolls. What other libraries would you say are significant that were lost? And it looks like we'll never know what was in there, what kind of information was lost.
Yeah, well, one of the largest ones in maybe some of our lifetimes is in Iraq, the libraries there. We destroyed thousands of artifacts in the Iraq and Baghdad during the war, you know, objects as well as documents and scrolls. And as is often happens in wars, in summer, Gilgamesh, who had the flood story that was way back in Babylonian days, that library as well was destroyed. You know, in a lot of these libraries, you know, we lose this information and we don't know what the information was exactly. And could it have helped us in today's world? You know, there's possibilities that could be.
Now, sometimes you talk about intentional destruction. And I think in Sumerian times, around 3000 BC or so, there was intentional destructions of the books because there's a new dynasty or a new emperor taking over. So obviously that happens as well, right? Because the new dynasty or the new emperor doesn't want people to relate to the previous one, right?
Yeah, for sure. And all kinds of knowledge gets lost. Maybe I'll talk about sewers a little bit here, because in ancient Rome, you know, we know they had a nice water distribution system with aqueducts, and they had a sewer system there. If we go as far back as, you know, Babylonians, they had, you know, 2400 BC, they had sewer systems as well. But if we go to look in the Middle Ages, in the 1300s, there were no sewer systems. And, you know, sewage ran off the top of buildings and into the streets, down the sides of the streets. And, you know, this is kind of an example of where when the destruction of Rome came and Roman technology was all lost, you know, the next generation in Europe that grew up didn't keep that same technology that they had. And they started all over again from scratch and started from, you know, probably contributed to the Black Plague and many people losing their lives unnecessarily. And, you know, if we would have kept that knowledge, it would have really helped humankind out.
Now, I know you start the book with a quote that sticks to my mind, and it's a quote from Socrates, the famous Greek philosopher, who says, "I know that I know nothing." And I think that's very significant because it really shows a degree of humbleness. And by being humble, you have the wisdom to actually learn something. If you think you know it all, then you're not going to learn much. So again, I like how you start the book that way. How do you relate that to today's world when everything that's happening?
Well, this is really kind of the point of the book. You know, when I started writing it, I said, "Oh, that's an interesting fact." And I put that down. You know, I said, "Oh, that's interesting." I put that down. And then I got to the end of the book and I said, well, what's the point? I mean, so what? We keep doing this over and over again. So what's the point? And I think the point is that we need to be humble and think about our future as well, because we don't do that. We don't do it enough is the real problem. We kept information on stone tablets, which last thousands of years. We moved to papyrus, which also can last a thousand years. Books and paper last a very long time. But as we move further and further into the future with DVDs or you know, USB thumb drives, those last 30 years, 40 years. I mean, the pits oxidize inside of those DVDs. They won't be readable again. Our SSD drives are electronics. I mean, how long do electronics last? You know, how long does your computer last? 5 years, maybe? I had an interesting experience. I was looking for an old photograph. And this happened yesterday, last night. And I found a whole bunch of old, you know, like USB drives and, you know, thumb drives, whatever. I had about 8 of them. And I was going through them all. And 2 of them wouldn't read. The computer wouldn't read them. They were dead.
Yes.
And we're thinking about how we can put more and more information in denser and denser ways onto electronics. But we're not thinking about how long is that information going to last? How long can I use it? How long can our children, will they be able to read it, or our children's children be able to?
That's exactly right. And I know you mentioned also in your book that currently I think your estimate is 1.6% of human knowledge has been preserved or we are aware of. And the other 98% is lost. And now let's talk about the digital age. So in the digital age, we have this great systems that in some way keep all the information or a lot of the information, but in so many other ways you can easily lose it all, right? Because like you said, technology and DVDs and all these things, first of all, the system you're going to read them on, they may not be maybe obsolete, or they may just not last as long as these other ancient devices would last. What else did you discover there when you analyzed the new systems versus the old ones?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I interviewed the Mark Weber, who at the time was the head curator at the Computer History Museum. He was telling me a story about how they have all these old PCs, you know, original PCs, IBM PCs, XT computers and Macintosh computers. And those all use floppy drives to save information. And those floppy drives, you know, the magnetic material becomes brittle and it cracks and it's no longer readable. So what they've had to do is take the computer programs and print them on paper.
Wow.
So that they could read them later. And isn't that going backwards? I mean, I don't know, but yes. To me, it seems like we're going backwards.
Yes, yes. Overall, how do you feel about the internet information overload that happens at the expense of, in so many ways, losing, you know, even music, but losing books, newspapers, and, you know, printed material versus the internet? How do you feel about that?
Well, I think the thing that we need to just think about a little bit is we're just thinking about how to use it, how to access it, how can we get the information maybe quicker, better, faster, which are all good things. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. But we also need to think about the future. I mean, how are we going to preserve that information? And maybe we need to be real thoughtful about what information we want to preserve. You know, maybe we don't want to preserve everything, like that gas receipt. You know, it doesn't really matter. But the internet, we're not thinking about what we should preserve, and we don't really have a good strategy for preservation of our information. There are examples of events that have happened in the past that could reoccur. I'm thinking of a Carrington event. They had a Carrington event in 1856. Where at that time, all that we had were telegraph. We had telegraph machines, and they had a wire between telegraph stations, and they know, use Morse code or whatever code to get the information from one telegraph station to the next. And they had a Carrington event, which is a very, very strong electromagnetic pulse that comes out from a solar storm from the sun. And that solar storm energized those wires and caught all the telegraph stations on fire. And not all of them, but I mean, some caught some of them on fire. What if we had one of those events today? What would happen? You know, would our data center be okay? Well, maybe it would, maybe it wouldn't. I don't know. But could there be some other side effects? I mean, your computer at home, would that, you know, still work? Depends. But yeah, you know, there are possibilities for things that could happen that might really disrupt our way of life.
Now, you also talk quite a bit about time capsules, which is something that's fascinating. As a kid, sometimes you make a time capsule, you say you're going to open it in 10 or 20 or 30 years. Tell us about that. What are some of the more significant ones that you have come across?
Well, there's a lot of really good ideas out there. For example, there is the Slivabard Seed Bank in Norway, where they're storing seeds. I think they have over 1 million seeds that they've stored in that seed bank. And now it's way up north where it's really cold, and they have to keep it even colder to preserve those seeds. And there's other attempts at time capsules to save information. But we have a tendency to lose time capsules. That's really crazy thing. There's a time capsule that George Washington buried at the White House. You know, that time capsule, it was buried in one of the cornerstones of the White House. And they've looked for it multiple times to try to find it. And they've been unsuccessful in finding it. I mean, maybe the latest renovation, maybe they found it this year, but haven't heard about it. But, you know, time capsules are good. But it's hard to figure out, you know, what are we going to put in a time capsule? How can we keep it from being lost? And, you know, how can it be around for future generations? You know, it's a difficult problem.
Speaking of that, we talk about technology and how competition drives technology in so many ways. Yeah. And the pursuit of money, you mentioned how it creates tunnel vision, because in so many ways, we're not really thinking what's really useful or what's useful for future generations. It's more of what is going to bring more money as far as a product. How would you see that can be solved? Do you see any ways to address this corruption, really, that money creates in so many ways?
Yeah. Well, you know, all it's going to take, and that's one of the goals of the book, you know, I hope that by bringing awareness to this topic, that it can create change. And the only way that we're going to be able to address it is by thinking about it. You know, when we put together a set of requirements to build something or whatever use cases we use, I'll use some technology terms here, we need to keep in mind, well, what about, is this stuff going to be important? Is whatever we're creating, do they need to use it in the future? Think about your car. I mean, how long do they make your car? Well, they make it long enough to last for the, you know, warranty. At least if you buy the additional warranty, you know, it'll last a little bit longer. But, you know, cars aren't made to last 500 years or 1,000 years. You know, drives, you know, little USB drive, thumb drive. How long are they made to last? We're not thinking about as a design, a part of the design, including how long will this thing be around? How long do we need it for? And so I think if we just have some thoughts in that, it'll help change.
And I want to conclude with the question of how do we minimize the loss of knowledge? And I know you did bring up the issue of wisdom and of good morals into this aspect. So can you expound on that?
Yeah. Well, I think if we're wise about what we do, you know, it's more than just knowledge. You know, knowledge, think about a child. Knowledge, you tell a child, hey, don't touch that stove over there. It's hot. You're going to burn yourself, right? But what happens? The child goes over and touches it anyways. And so that's wisdom. That's being wise. You're not going to touch that hot stove again. And so maybe we can learn from the past and say, hey, we keep losing this information over and over again. I'm going to be a little humble and think about, how can I make a difference? How can I make a difference for the future for our children and our children's children so that they'll have the same information that I have and they can live a better life as well?
Jack, we thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it. It's been a very fascinating topic that really brings to mind a lot of these ancient discoveries that people really don't think about all the time. So thank you so much for your time.
Joined with our dodecahedron.
Yes. All right. Thank you so much. Appreciate your time.
Yeah. Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you for watching another episode of Bay Area Innovators. If you enjoyed this episode and you know someone who should be on our show, please send us an email at sfbay@epochtimes.com. We would love to hear from you. Thank you and see you next week.